The average person in France knew that Charlie Hebdo stood for left-wing, iconoclastic, anti-racism, anti-homophobic beliefs.
A bloodbath that a French satirical weekly has put a spotlight on press freedom and its vulnerability. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Also on the show, businesses that thrive on the virality of other people's content. As for the actual creators of said content,
we make a living the old-fashioned way, and we can't eat clicks or tweets.
And the most futuristic predictions that became reality in 2014.
Number one on my list, the first ever successful demonstration of mind-to-mind communication between humans.
There's so much more after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Liberté d'expression! Liberté d'expression!
Much of the Western world was horrified this week by a massacre at a French weekly, Charlie Hebdo, which specializes in caustic line-crossing cartoons. Here's French President François Hollande.
It's an act of exceptional barbarity that has just been committed here in Paris against a newspaper that stands for freedom of expression, against journalists determined to defend their ideas and the liberty that the Republic protects.
Charlie Hebdo was known for equal opportunity skewering, especially in the realms of religion and politics. But it was notorious for its scorching, sometimes salacious depictions of the Prophet Muhammad.
Our job is not to defend freedom of speech, but without freedom of speech, we are dead.
That was Charlie Hebdo's editorial director, Stéphane Charbonnier, speaking to ABC News a year after the paper had been firebombed after an especially risky issue, one which the paper audaciously declared had been edited by Muhammad himself, who was depicted nude. Charbonnier was murdered Wednesday, along with 11 others, including one Muslim policeman, by gunmen captured on video. It was horrific, sickening, and yes, an unambiguous attack on a core democratic principle, free speech. Many in the past had often accused the paper of going too far. That was its raison d'être. But the gunman who committed the massacre, killed Friday when police stormed their hideout, turned Charlie Hebdo into a cause célèbre.
Daniel Schneiderman, a longtime media critic, is editor of the French media criticism website Arrêt sur Image. He's followed the path of Charlie Hebdo since its birth in 1970.
You know, they have always been very anti-cleric.
Mm-hmm.
But being anti-cleric in the 60s or in the 70s, that meant being anti-pope and anti-Catholic clerics. And it all changed when the new century started.
Mm-hmm.
They started to cartoon against Islam, and it became harder and harder for them. The situation got mm-hmm. more extreme
mm-hmm.
on both sides. I sometimes thought they were going too far.
Mm-hmm.
They came to my show and we debated about that, and some people told them, "Why do you humiliate Muslim people?" And they defended themselves. I was very happy we could have this debate in a freedom country, which is France. I think censorship is never a good solution. I learned today, for instance, that the New York Times did not publish their cartoons. I think that's not a good solution.
You wondered whether or not they had gone too far. Now you feel that news outlets should be publishing some of those
yes.
very same crass cartoons.
Yes, of course. There's no contradiction. It has a right to be published. You must be able to debate about it. That's mm-hmm. it. And today I'm just horrified by what happened. I want this newspaper, I want this magazine to still be able to go too far in the next years. That's very important. We hear about this sort of issues in countries that are very far away from us. We hear about these issues in Mexico. We hear about these issues in Colombia. We hear about these issues in Middle East countries. But in France, we could never imagine we could face such a drama.
Several French mosques have already been attacked in the very short period since the attack on Charlie Hebdo. Does that worry you?
Yes, of course. I think most French people don't think that Muslims in general are responsible for what happened. Muslims in general strongly disagree with, with this terrible massacre.
But does this provide an opportunity for the right-wing and nationalist parties to dig in their heels? I mean, do you find some irony in the fact that the right wing has to stand with a left-wing journal that it's long hated? I mean, only last week, the cover featured former rightist President Sarkozy having sex with male homophobes.
Yeah, well, what's very funny is not Sarkozy. What's very funny is the extreme-right leader Marine Le Pen wanting to demonstrate for Charlie Hebdo.
The ultra-nationalist party in France.
Yeah, which is very high in the polls, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Hebdo was very hard against her. They depicted them as Nazis. And now she goes saying, I want to have a very huge demonstration next Sunday in Paris. We are in a very ironic situation in France. I remember September 11th. I remember how something broke inside of me. I felt the same. Exactly the same when I learned about this massacre. I felt very strongly that there had been a before and there should be an after. On September 11, nobody could say what would happen in the next years in America. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, we are in the same situation.
Daniel Schneiderman is editor of the French media criticism website Arrêts sur Image. Lawrence Grove is a professor of French text and image studies at the University of Glasgow, where he specializes in French cartoons. He also has an apartment in Paris, not far from the offices of Charlie Hebdo. He says that cartoons have long played a crucial role in French politics and culture, starting in the 19th century, but especially in the years after World War II.
And that's where I'd say that France particularly came into its own, because the communists and the Catholics, the two main ruling parties at the time, used comics to put their message forward. So if you're a young communist kid, you'd be reading Vaillant, you'd be seeing a dog called Pif le Chien, and you'd be knowing that that dog was far better than any consumerist mouse that somebody else might put across the Atlantic. On the other hand, if you were a Catholic child, you'd be reading Coeur Vaillant, but this wouldn't have a communist dog outwitting Coca-Cola. This would be telling you how to lead a good, wholesome life and make sure that you wash properly in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the kids reading this would enjoy the stories. I've known friends who've grown up with Pif le Chien, and they didn't know he was a communist dog at all.
But then how would you place Charlie Hebdo in this context? I mean, you called the shooting an attack on a national institution. Was this carrying on a propagandistic tradition?
Part of what Charlie Hebdo did was to show people that comics weren't just for kids. We can now be fully and openly adult. Sexual references, scatology. I won't tell you exactly what Sarkozy was doing in the last issue of Charlie Hebdo, but it was very rude and it didn't involve clothing. This was a way of getting at what they consider to be his closed-mindedness by showing him doing exactly what he was criticising other people for doing. It was a journal which has always been on the cutting edge of looking to say what really is taboo and not allowed and then doing exactly that.
Charlie Hebdo was born out of L'Hebdo Harakiri, which was closed in 1970 by the French government after it mocked the death of Charles de Gaulle. So we're going back a ways. I mean, many of the people who died were quite old, 76 years old, 80 years old. These were old hippies or yippies, right?
Yep. Kebu, the person with whom I had the honor and pleasure to work, was very much a 68-er. He was out manning the barricades in
1968.
In 1968, when the riots were happening in France, it was the underground, it was Robert Crumb. One of the things he said was what he really wanted was a fairer society. And I think even up to yesterday, he lived with that 1960s ideal of just making things better for people.
Such purity side by side with so much cynicism.
That's it. There's so many contradictions. It was a left-wing idealistic organization that would go out and offend absolutely everybody.
Right. I went through some of the covers. I saw pedophile priests, the birth of Jesus, a range of politicians. But the ones that have been most notable, at least from an international perspective, would be the ones that are related to Muhammad. In October 2011, they picked up on the Danish Muhammad cartoon scandal by publishing an issue guest edited by Muhammad and rebranded Sharia Hebdo.
That was one of the famous ones, and it was in the wake of that that the police protection was put on Charlie Hebdo. Apparently now that particular issue has been going on the market and selling for quite a high price.
In 2012, in the wake of outrage in the Muslim world over a YouTube video called The Innocence of Muslims, Charlie Hebdo published a series of cartoons, again of the Prophet. One is something that says, "The film that will set the Muslim world on fire," and you see him lying naked in a bed, being filmed from behind, saying, "Do you like it, my rear end?" Which I guess is a reference to the 1963 Godard film Contempt, in which Brigitte Bardot asks pretty much the same question.
This wasn't just stupid humor, although they liked to pretend it was. It was humor with all sorts of cross-literary references, intertextuality. It was Monty Python, but 50 times as rude.
Monty Python crossed with Mad Magazine, crossed with South Park.
Yep, and doing even things that even South Park couldn't get away with.
Can you tell me about the last cartoon it published?
On the day of the massacre, it had tweeted a cartoon showing the leader of ISIS wishing everybody a happy new year and, above all, good health. The fact that they were so taboo-breaking right to the end that the people running Charlie Hebdo left this cartoon, which was really the blackest of black humour, on their Facebook page even after the attack, was saying to the outside world, excuse my French, it was saying merde. Mm-hmm. And they were going to continue, and they've announced that there will be Wednesday's issue as normal. Well, no, not as normal, because the print run is due to be a million copies.
Mm. Now, it had a huge number of enemies, mostly on the right, and I'm assuming those people must be feeling some cognitive dissonance this week, because it's always condemned the weekly, and now it may feel compelled to defend it, right?
It could almost be a perfect cartoon for Charlie Hebdo. So you're in this situation where you have a certain, as you say, right-wing, implicitly racist, Islamophobic population who hated Charlie Hebdo. These are the very people who, in jest, probably would have said these lot deserve to be shot down. Well, now that they have been shot down, how are they reacting? Who shot them down? The very people the racists are racist against.
But a person who might conflate this kind of extremism with the religion in general will find it very easy to harden in their views.
I think the average person in France knows Charlie Hebdo. It's a household name, and they know what Charlie Hebdo stood for. That Charlie Hebdo stood for left-wing, iconoclastic, anti-racism, anti-homophobic beliefs. I think the questions are coming maybe from outside readers who, mm-hmm, you could take individual copies and who could see individual images, see them out of context. When you don't know the people, you don't know the struggles and their history, you can see some of these images and say, yes, that's sexist, homophobic, Islamophobic. But that's not the context of the journal.
This kind of publication, the tradition, is known as the irresponsible press, right?
Yeah, the Journal Irresponsable was its nickname it gave itself.
So ultimately, what do you think will be the impact of this attack on that, on free speech in France in general, and on the public's appetite for it?
Well, I think we're seeing that already. We're getting people out in the streets. We're seeing national shows of solidarity. We're seeing a print run of a million. We're seeing the magazine continuing. It was in financial difficulty 2 days ago. Well, it certainly isn't now.
It isn't?
We're seeing financial aid coming from sources who probably never would have given it financial aid in the past. It's once again put the visual medium of cartooning at the forefront of French culture. It's always been something which the French have proudly said, what do we beat the Americans at? We beat them at jazz, we beat them at detective novels, we beat them at comics.
Jazz! Oh, come on.
This is being seen worldwide as something for which France has a special place and it excels. You might not agree in the way it excels, but it certainly excels.
Lawrence, thank you very much.
An absolute pleasure.
Lawrence Grove is a professor of French text and image studies at the University of Glasgow, where he specializes in French cartoons. Jeffrey Goldberg is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He arrived in Paris the day after the attack when the city was papered with Je suis Charlie posters in solidarity with the murdered cartoonists. On Thursday, he wrote an article titled We Are Not All Charlie for TheAtlantic.com. He says the posters proclaiming that we are all Charlie suggest we share its courage. He says journalists, at least, are not all as brave as the posters suggest.
Before we all sort of congratulate ourselves on what great, brave avatars of freedom we all are, let's just look at the reality of the situation. And in our profession, I don't see uniform bravery. Let's just call it that.
You wrote that to publish the cartoons now is a necessary but only moderately brave act. What is a brave act?
The staff of this newspaper was unbelievably brave. I remember in 2011, they had been firebombed already. They knew that they had targets on their backs, and they continued to do exactly what they wanted to do, which was to mock Islamist beliefs. And by the way, I am not endorsing or decrying the content. I'm saying that they were brave because they pursued the truth as they understood it. That's brave. I mean, it is somewhat brave, as I say, for news outlets today to publish these. I was very glad to see the Washington Post put a cartoon in its op-ed page. But now it's so widely disseminated. You know, you diffuse the danger because they can't possibly kill everyone. Going second or third or fourth is different than going first.
You wrote that CNN, the Associated Press, many other news organizations are cowering before the threat of totalitarian violence and represent something other than bravery.
I think so. I'm sorry to say it, but I think that both on sort of the straight moral grounds of saying to people who would have this profession self-censor, no, we're not going to do that. And in fact, in honor of these brave cartoonists who gave their lives for free expression, we're going to disseminate their work further. I think that there's a solid argument to be made there, but I think there's an even more solid practical argument to be made, which is that these cartoons sit at the heart of this story. If you're not showing your readers and your viewers what these cartoons are, I don't think you're performing a service. Here's an analogy, and like all analogies, it's inexact, but let's just say the President of the United States, or another world leader, used an FCC forbidden word in a speech, or went on a rant that was not, shall we say, fit for a family newspaper. Do you report on it? Yes, because it's the President of the United States, because it's a world leader. Do you censor it because it's uncomfortable or unpalatable? No, I don't think you do, and I think that's the same thing that we're dealing with here.
Among the people that you say is not Charlie is Barack Obama. And you quote a speech that he delivered at the United Nations General Assembly in 2012.
The future must not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam. But to be credible, those who condemn that slander must also condemn the hate we see in the images of Jesus Christ that are desecrated, or churches that are destroyed, or the Holocaust that is denied.
This line, the future must not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam. Well, I mean, satire is one of the forces that created modern political freedom. I mean, the ability to mock power is essential to creating democracy and openness across the world. So, in fact, the future has to belong to those who would slander the Prophet of Islam. We're not in the business of defending inoffensive speech. No one's standard is going to be like the next person's. I wish that what the president said was, look, we have sacred principles in the United States, and one of them is freedom of speech. And one of the things we're allowed to do in America is mock religious beliefs. Another is to mock the president. You should see what they say about me. Is it painful to me? Yes. Is it painful to adherents of different faiths when they hear their religious beliefs mocked? Of course it's painful. I don't endorse blasphemy, but I defend the right of people to blaspheme. That would have been, I think, a more American message in line with our own sacred beliefs, if you will.
Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine.
Coming up, an example of a business that makes a mint out of virality on the back of others' hard work. And there's not much anyone can do about it.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In this week's New Yorker, Andrew Marantz writes about a young entrepreneur, Emerson Spartz, and his website, Dose. Dose is an aggregator, one of many sites that collects content from around the internet. But unlike Google News, Boing Boing, Slashdot, or even the Huffington Post, Dose doesn't always excerpt content and link back to the original source. It copies others' content wholesale and optimizes it with editing and headline treatment. But while Marantz's piece was not flattering to Emerson Spartz, it left open the question of whether author ownership has been made obsolete by the internet.
You know, there are billions of photographs being published to the internet, and then there are billions more remashes and remixes and Photoshops and changes and alterations and different spins and angles taken on those original works of art.
Emerson Spartz of Spartz Media.
At the core of it is we are scouring the web, looking for content that we believe our audience will enjoy and that they will share. So we always try to give credit when we can identify who the original source was of that photograph. But we live in a remix world.
The New Yorker article centers on one particular piece of shared content from 2014, a slideshow of 23 people from around the world posing with the food they typically consume in one day. From 900 calories for an impoverished Botswana mom to the 5,400 calories of fast food for an Illinois truck driver. The images were drawn from a 2010 book by Peter Menzel and Faith DeLugio titled What I Eat Around the World in 80 Diets, a volume of photojournalism compiled through a vast expense of time, money, and creative ingenuity. List price for the book, $40. The Dose piece mentioned the author's names, but made no reference to the book. By contrast, when Wired.com used some of those images, it linked directly to the book's Amazon page and quoted the authors. That was fined by Menzel, who is not unsympathetic to the Spartz argument of expanding the reach of the author's journalism within the bounds of fair play.
If people really understand and take the work and think about it and know the real purpose and reason behind it, yes, that's good. But we make a living the old-fashioned way, and we can't eat clicks or tweets.
It's not just that Dose, as Spartz would have it, skims the cream from billions of images of uncertain provenance on the web. The site uses its proprietary algorithm to flag internet memes before they peak, and then often simply cuts and pastes entire slideshows. It then distributes the items, stimulates sharing on Facebook, and sells millions of dollars worth of ads seen by those drawn to the content.
I don't know what he can say in his defense.
Richard Stimm is a copyright lawyer and blogger.
The straight out copying without any public benefit is never going to be excused as a fair use, or it shouldn't be.
Stim says that in the internet age, copyright and fair use have become murky. As Spartz asserts, we are now in a remix world, a sampling world, a sharing world, a curation world. But when people say all information should be free, well, to paraphrase the great Inigo Montoya, I do not think it means what they think it means. Freedom of speech does not mean freedom to plagiarize other people's speech and to profit from it. Yet in the Wild West of the World Wide Web, content repackagers like Spartz operate with impunity, telling aggrieved copyright holders if they don't like the reach they're enjoying by having their work expropriated, they can always file a takedown notice under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, even though that law was meant to protect internet service providers, not pirates.
It used to be in the world of copyright, like you would ask for permission or ask for forgiveness, but he's in a new world. If you look at his site on the bottom of the page, there's how to file a DMCA notice. So he's looking to take advantage of the safe harbor and avoid all liability completely. And if you do have to take it down, I mean, probably the shelf life on the list that you're getting taken down is already over. So it really doesn't matter to him. I mean, I think he lives in a world beyond copyright.
And maybe we all do. Even Andrew Morant, whose piece portrays Spartz as a blind opportunist subordinating others' rights to the desires of the free market, can't entirely dismiss the underlying rationale or rationalization.
He thinks that what the market wants is ultimately to the good, and I'm not so sure about that. The First Amendment is a very broad and powerful protection, which is in most cases obviously a good thing. But where it gets complicated is that you have kind of an unregulated market when it comes to speech, writing, photography, art, journalism. You can't really put many restrictions on what people do when it comes to speech, so it's kind of up in the air.
Is it? Intellectual property is still property, the output of the author's time, investment, and ingenuity. You don't have a cash cow if someone is helping themselves to the milk for free. I asked Spartz why lifting the slideshow wasn't just theft. Now, Emerson, there is the remix world that we're living in that you correctly describe, and then there's the ransacking world. At least in the case of the Peter Menzel photos, this wasn't a case of locating individual pieces of content from the stuffosphere and assembling them to make a larger point. This was a case of somebody who assembled images for a book that was itself copyrighted and sells that work for his livelihood.
It wasn't like we just went and bought the book, scanned the photos, and put them up. We did this. There were thousands of other sites that were putting these same photos online. And I would argue that there are several million people who saw these photos and had a mind-expanding experience as a result of us publishing these photos that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
So let me ask you this, Emerson. What if I were to found a website called MemeMe.com, which incredibly is not taken? And what if I just took everything that's on Dose, took out the bylines, and otherwise, maybe changed the graphic display, but otherwise just lifted it all, just cut it, pasted it into MemeMe, and started another company doing exactly what you're doing, encouraging sharing based on your proprietary algorithm and selling advertising against the clicks at MemeMe. Wouldn't you be kind of put out?
I wouldn't care because we're not actually competing. Nobody chooses, should I go to MemeMe today or should I go to Dose.com today? They don't. They just are on Facebook and their friend shares an article and they see it. And if it looks good, they'll click it. And then if it is good, they'll share it. And there are thousands and thousands of memes out there that are competing with us every day. Something goes viral and there are hundreds or thousands of other websites that publish the same thing. And then it's a competition to see who can get more page views onto their article.
As I said, the Wild West, brutal and lawless, and where the slow or weak are gunned down in the street. Lawyer Richard Stim agrees that technology and economic reality, such as the onerous cost of suing deep-pocketed media companies, have left copyright law impotent to stay ahead of infringers, righteous or otherwise. He can be prodded, though, into musing about ultimate justice.
Morally, yeah, it seems kind of reprehensible. You know, the other thing about DOSE is sometimes websites do get shut down because they violate the law so much that eventually it just doesn't work. I mean, remember Napster? All of a sudden it was gone. Websites disappear, and then new startups learn from their mistakes and or pop up with some other thing and get shot down. That's just the way it is. So,
but in the meantime, what happens to Peter Menzel and Faith DeLuja?
Yeah, in answer to your question, I think they're kind of screwed.
Coming up, the top journalism screw-ups of last year and the coolest futuristic breakthroughs.
This is On the Media.
Hey, it's Meredith from TLDR.
I saw his video on the front page, and I was like, this guy kind of looks like Jesus.
On this week's episode, God, silence, community, connection, and an unbelievable cover song called Baby Got Book. To hear this week's episode and every other episode of TLDR, subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And listen to all 42. Be a completist.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Before we rush intrepidly into 2015 with big hopes and dreams about the new year in media, let's take stock of how journalism fared in the year we've just left behind us. As always, Craig Silverman, author of the Regret the Error blog on Pointer, joins us for a roundup of 12 months of reporting screw-ups. The particulars are always amusing, in a depressing sort of way. The underlying carelessness, and worse, is timeless and immutable, in a very depressing sort of way. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
As usual, you have a correction of the year.
And what a correction of the year it is. It combines some wonderful elements. Kanye West and his wife, Kim Kardashian, both of their butts. So here is the correction of the year. An earlier version of this column was published in error. That version included what purported to be an interview that Kanye West gave to a Chicago radio station in which he compared his own derriere to that of his wife, Kim Kardashian. Mr. West's quotes were taken without attribution from the satirical website, The Daily Current. There is no radio station, WGYN, in Chicago. The interview was fictitious and should not have been included in the column.
Okay, now we constantly see these stories that are plucked from the Daily Current or the Onion or something showing up in Russia Today or the China State News Agency as actual news. The source of this correction, Craig?
Oh, this was in the New York Times.
I think we should call out NPR for a mistake that is notable. Would you care to share?
Sure. So here's the correction from NPR. An earlier version of this story said that the methane emissions associated with livestock come from their farts. In fact, most of those methane emissions come from belches.
You got to credit NPR and the New York Times and other news organizations of quality for owning up to mistakes, no matter how silly.
It's kind of a paradox in some ways in that you're more likely to be trusted the more willing you are to point out all the things you screw up. In fact, there's a study done back in the 1990s by what was the American Society of Newspaper Editors at the time. It found that a majority of people felt much better when they saw corrections in newspapers because they saw that there was some kind of accountability in place.
Now, you have a category this year that you call Watchdog of the Year, and it's particularly interesting to us at On the Media because it refers to something that we thought about covering and ultimately did not. And we didn't because we weren't comfortable with the sourcing. The underlying story is whether or not Fareed Zakaria of CNN and elsewhere is a plagiarist, an accusation that was floated a couple of years back and kind of semi-apologized for, but it did not disappear.
Well, I think it disappeared in terms of the news outlets that publish his work and employ him, but it didn't disappear for two people who go by pseudonyms, Blippo Bloppo and Crushing Bort. These are two people who have a blog called Our Bad Media, and for some reason, after everything died down about Zakaria, they decided to go back and look into his work. He had been cleared by the Washington Post, he had received a little bit of a suspension from his employers at the time, and then he was back at work on CNN and elsewhere. And what they found was that in spite of the fact that these news organizations said they didn't really find any additional examples of plagiarism, they very easily did.
By the very sophisticated technique of taking passages from Zakaria and Googling them to see if they got other hits.
They exposed that these news organizations did a very inadequate job of reviewing Zakaria's previous work, and they kept going back to the well, not only for his work writing for Newsweek and Time and the Washington Post, but they looked at some of his transcripts from CNN, they looked at some of his books, and brought up really troubling stuff in those as well.
On the Media finally decided, as much as we wag our scolding fingers at the overuse of anonymous sources, especially political stories, that we did not want to depend on anonymous watchdogs to go into the Zakaria allegations. And I guess you think that we blew that one, huh?
Yeah, I guess I'll say that. I mean, I do think there's a difference between anonymous sources and pseudonymous sources. So these two people, they're on Twitter and they're active. You can talk to them. You can interact with them. They have a dedicated blog where they're putting up the material, and you can go and check for yourself. So I don't know what more we really need to ask for in order to take it seriously.
Well, I think we did make a mistake, and I apologize. And on the subject of apologies, let's talk about one from the online magazine IO9. You call it a textbook example of how a top-level editor should handle a major mistake.
They had a story focused on animal welfare in research experiments. The site's editor is Annalie Newitz, and in her very frank post about it, here's how it starts. On Wednesday, we published an article about animal welfare in research experiments. It was biased, factually incorrect, and should not have appeared on IO9 in that form. As IO9's editor-in-chief, I'm the one who screwed up, and I'm sorry. Here's how this mess happened and what we're doing about it.
I'm interested in it mainly because of what another news organization did not do after reporting that was biased, factually incorrect, and shouldn't have appeared in any form. And I refer, of course, to the infamous Rolling Stone campus rape story, which you say is the 2014 error of the year.
The story is that a student at the University of Virginia says that she was gang raped while at a party being run by a campus frat. Rolling Stone had a reporter who was looking to write about rape on campus. And so as she described later to Slate in a podcast, she went looking to different campuses to find the right victim, the right account to really symbolize what's going on with rape on campus. It seems from that moment forward, she was inclined to really take anything that made the school and the incident look really bad and frats look really bad and not really dig in to get the truth of the story. And to be clear about this, I'm not saying the rape didn't happen. I don't think we actually know what happened. And that's the problem. Rolling Stone ran a really large feature story, and yet the reporter didn't interview the people who were accused and also quoted friends of the victim verbatim, even though she didn't even interview them. And so after the Washington Post dug into this story, it became clear that Rolling Stone really played up a story that they didn't have the goods on.
Causing endless damage not only to the reputation of Rolling Stone and the University of Virginia and the particular fraternity, but to all women who subsequently discuss their rapes and now have to deal with public skepticism about their very, very real horrors.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that Rolling Stone had confirmation bias to try and find the worst possible story to really make people care about this. But the way that they handled it has now given critics a way to minimize rape on campus. It's had the exact opposite effect that they wanted.
And the editors of Rolling Stone did what?
Initially, they blamed the victim. They said that their trust in her was misplaced. So instead of taking responsibility, they kind of put it on her. On top of that, they didn't share any details about how the story was reported, and they didn't say anything about what they were really planning to do about it.
So once again, Craig, you haven't proven me a liar, as promised in the introduction. That's pretty depressing.
Yeah, it's often a depressing roundup to put together, with the exception of some really enjoyable corrections where you see news organizations embracing their errors. But hopefully they read it, and it's a little bit of a roadmap of things that they won't do in the coming year.
All right, man. With some trepidation, I say I'll talk to you again next year.
Thanks, and hope to see you in the Post next year.
You mean in your Post?
Yes.
I so don't. Craig Silverman writes the Regret the Error blog at Poynter.com, where you can find the rest of his annual roundup of the year's media errors.
After considering the biggest bloopers of 2014, we thought we'd end with a palate cleanser. This year's most futuristic breakthroughs. Like Doc and Marty McFly in Back to the Future 2, we finally landed at 2015.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to borrow your hoverboard.
We don't yet have hoverboards, but some of the film's predictions came early, like glasses with built-in phones, which went on the market in May last year as Google Glass. George Dvorsky, a contributing editor at IO9 and director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, has peered into the past year to find the most futuristic predictions that became reality.
Number one on my list, the first ever successful demonstration of mind-to-mind communication between humans. The two individuals involved, one was in India and one was in France, and the words that were transmitted between the two of them included hola, for example.
So they said hello to each other using a cap, brain to brain, and nothing else.
It used transcranial direct stimulation in the brain to light up the person's peripheral vision. They would literally see spots in their peripheral vision, and these spots of light would indicate to them a numerical sequence. And using that numerical sequence, they're able to decode the binary to come up with the messages that were being sent to them.
So basically, they were given a code.
But they did manage to decode it strictly by looking at the flashing of the lights in the peripheral vision of their eyes. And we're very much heading to this space where we can, in fact, communicate with each other in a nonverbal way. And where that will lead us as a civilization and as individual humans is hard to predict. But one thing that's, I think, pretty clear is that, again, the immediacy of communication, the levels of intimacy between each other, the ability to collaborate quickly and rapidly and across vast distances will certainly, I think, change the fabric of how we interact with each other.
And as a futurist, you don't find this in any way creepy.
One thing that worries me is the inability, for example, to detach from such a system. And in fact, one of the items that I did not put on the list this year, but I think really did belong on the list, this was the first year where Google Glass addiction was actually diagnosed as a disorder, and it was actually treated by military personnel on an American citizen. He was quite habitually using his Google Glass. He had to remove it for medical reasons. He would fixate on it. He kept trying to reach for it with his finger to try to turn it on and would talk to it. He even had dreams that he was wearing it, and they treated it as if he had any kind of internet addiction disorder.
Mm-hmm. I was really surprised when I read that an artificial intelligence was elected to the board of a Hong Kong company. Was that for real or just a publicity stunt? Would the AI have voting rights?
Yes, the AI would, in fact, have voting rights. It is a full and equal member, like a proportional member, on their board of directors. It's a venture capital firm. What this is, it's a machine learning program that's very, very capable of analyzing incredibly massive data sets. And then also using various calculations, come up with proposals for what it thinks the company should invest in. Some people thought this was a bit of a publicity stunt, and that may be so. But personally, I did see it as a kind of precursor for other kinds of ways that artificial intelligence will start to make its way into the upper echelons of both companies, governments, and even potentially the military.
Speaking of robots intruding into the boardrooms or maybe the military, this year, researchers at something called the Open Worm Project uploaded the brain of a worm to a robot. I've seen the video you posted. It just kind of looks like the robot is banging against the wall. What's the significance of it?
So this is the idea that the brain is a kind of a functional machine, if you will, that can both exist not only in a biological way, but it can also exist in a digital way.
There are many who believe that you couldn't do that with, say, a human brain because it's experiences Yes. that are built up, the intuition that comes into play. Its responses can't be translated into digits.
I am quite skeptical that we can synthesize consciousness in a machine. I believe there is something going on in the physical world that is what gives rise to consciousness. And that's a, mm-hmm. my opinion, by the way, is in the extreme minority. What I think we'll eventually do is we'll create hybrid systems for uploading. So I think that we're going to be talking about hybrid biological and digital systems where human beings will, for the most part, be in a computer, but there might have to be certain functions that still can't be completely resident inside of it.
So relate this to the nematode brain in the robot. What does that portend?
Sure. They're not finished yet mapping the brain of a nematode worm. But what they did do was they created a software program that reflects how a nematode worm navigates throughout the world. Should it reach an object, what does it do? That was the information that was uploaded into a Lego Mindstorms robot. And according to the researchers, it did not move in a chaotic, haphazard way. When it did reach a wall or some kind of an obstacle, it moved in pretty much the same way you would have expected a nematode worm to work. So mm-hmm. is it true uploading of a worm into a robot? No, not quite. Is it a portent? Is what maybe more substantive down the line? I think absolutely. So this is one of the first steps that I have ever seen that could be considered a form of upload of a biological system into a digital one.
Another potential biomedical breakthrough, scientists built an artificial chromosome from scratch.
Yes, and this was a project that was about 10 years in the making. They created a very lean and mean version of a yeast chromosome, albeit a synthetic one, and they put it to use in an actual organism, and wouldn't you know it, it actually worked. The yeast actually functioned fine with a synthetic chromosome that was made in a laboratory. What was also quite remarkable about this particular breakthrough was the researchers also managed to create a kind of synthetic chromosome that is modifiable, that it has the ability, for example, for the geneticists to switch some of the functions on and off and to even add certain functions in the future. So what this means is that we can start to create, for example, better medicines, better delivery methods for medicines in particular, but also a way to now even think about how we might even translate this particular technology to the human chromosome. Although I would say that particular breakthrough will await us in the distant future, but eventually we'll be able to do similar things in terms of tweaking the human chromosome to give us new functions or to improve our health and so on and so forth.
New functions?
Dr. Gregory Stock, for example, has speculated that we could give ourselves ultraviolet vision or even the capacity to see in the dark, or, for example, to have built-in immunities to pathogens like HIV, AIDS, or Ebola, or what have you, built-in vaccinations at a genetic level. That's the power of artificial chromosomes. That was the breakthrough this year as it pertained to yeast, an important proof of concept that shows, look, we can, in fact, create these things in the lab, put it in a functional organism, watch it work, and then externally continue to modify it and shape it as we see fit.
But can you get the political and religious and cultural establishments to accept it?
That is certainly an open question. We have to then decide collectively if it's in our best interest.
So speaking of social conundra, some of the breakthroughs were not, strictly speaking, technological at all. The introduction in North America of genderless pronouns. Would you spell them?
Sure. Well, it's spelled X-E, X-E-M, and X-Y-R, and it's pronounced Z, Zem, and Zir. And that's what you would say when a gendered pronoun, like he or she or him or her, is deemed inappropriate. This has been done in Sweden, by the way. And in this particular instance, it was the Vancouver School Board that introduced these genderless pronouns. And the idea is, let's say, for example, you have transgendered people or intersexed people or anyone who simply wishes to not be identified strictly according to their sex can have these pronouns used. That's definitely been a staple in science fiction, by the way. Science fiction writers for years have kind of imagined future humans as being amorphic as it comes to their gender or even having multiple genders or new genders altogether, and have wondered how will that alter language. So not only is this, I think, a step forward in terms of our appreciation and respect for, let's say, trans people or intersex people, but it also shows how our language is continuing to evolve.
If you were going to sum up the breakthroughs of 2014 and what it told us about the kind of future we were heading into, how would you put it?
I would say that 2014 was a potent reminder that many of the visions that we have in our science fiction is in fact happening, that we are very much heading into a world in which artificial intelligence will supplant human decision-making, where our biomedical technologies are going to continue to help enable the disabled, help us deal with diseases we weren't able to deal with before, and to extend life in ways that we hadn't imagined.
Where are the big risks that you see in the breakthroughs of 2014?
A number of leading thinkers have warned that we're heading down a very dangerous path as we continue to develop more and more powerful artificial intelligence. And the fear is that eventually these decision-making machines will start to make mistakes in ways that will harm us quite badly. These things will be very narrow, dedicated systems that will have more power over the environment than humans do and can change things quicker than we're going to be able to react to them.
Speaking of which, another breakthrough you noted was that a computer solved a math problem that was so complicated that human mathematicians couldn't check it.
It was the longstanding Erdos discrepancy problem. And what the computer did was it apparently, again, it was difficult for us to know because the answer was too long for us to check. In fact, the study authors claimed that the answer was longer than all of the pages of Wikipedia combined. So the computer could have been completely wrong. It may have been completely right. But unfortunately, there isn't anybody right now who has the wherewithal to check if that is, in fact, the answer to this particular mathematical problem.
George, thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
George Dvorsky is a contributing editor to IO9 and director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. You can go to IO9 and see his article, The Most Futuristic Predictions That Came True in 2014.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sarah Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, and Kasia Mihailovic. We had more help from Jesse Brenneman, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Merritt Jacob.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.